Hi, I'm Aria Evans. Welcome to the D Word Podcast, where we work to demystify dance. Forms of movement have been practiced since time immemorial. I'm here to reveal insights into why physical expression matters, what it does in our bodies when we watch it, and how it lives within our daily lives. This season, our theme is transformation. Transforming relationships, identity, our way of thinking, and social hierarchies through movement. How does dance do this? Let's dive in and find out. This episode, we are speaking with Shannon Litzenberger. Shannon is an award-winning choreographer, director, and embodiment facilitator. Her imaginative collaborations connect art forms and communities, centering participatory experiences in artistic processes. The creative principles and embodied practices she works with regularly in the studio are also central to her work in leadership development, organizational culture development, and systems change. She works frequently across corporate, academic, and nonprofit spaces in support of creating a healthier, more interconnected, equitable, and resilient society. So I know you as someone who does many, 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 many things. And I'm curious if you can share with our listeners how you specifically describe your embodiment leadership practice. Like, what does that look like?
Well, because my work sort of cuts across or intersects within the world of art making and the world of leadership development and the world of systems change, my practice of leadership development also integrates these three spaces. So I'm working with movement-based, embodied, felt sense experience practices to bring about new collective habits, new group dynamics, and new ways of being together that create different kinds of leadership, more collaborative leadership, leadership that is less hierarchical, less about oversight, and more about shared practice.
When I think about like all of the conversations that we've had as friends, as colleagues, as collaborators, I always sort of zero in that the central theme that it feels like you return to often in many of your practices is about change making. And I'm curious why that's important to you.
Well, I think it's maybe an obvious thing to say, but I'll say it anyways.
I'm going to say
the obvious. Change is important because how things are aren't great.
Yeah.
And, you know, I mean, I think, you know, the pandemic revealed that in spades. But also, like, you know, for many of us, it didn't take a pandemic to understand that there are many oppressive dynamics at play in our society and structures that are designed to create harm, whether intentionally or unintentionally, in the ways that our world is governed, the way that our world is led, the way that our world is organized. And so, yes, change is important. But I think maybe one of the more specific inquiries right now is change to what? What are we actually changing toward? And I think that this is, you know, through my research, I am working on becoming more specific about that. And the places that are sources of wisdom for me are both like indigenous cosmologies and creative practice. And I think these two spaces have a strong relationship because, you know, indigenous cosmologies are inherently relational and think about being in right relationship with self, others, and the natural world. And they are earth cosmologies. They understand that our survival is inherently coupled to the health of our planet, of Mother Earth. And, you know, creative capacities work on those relationships. The creative capacities, you know, that you and I work with in the studio, they are designed to shift relationships to self, others, and the world around us. I mean, artists through these creative capacities are world making. We're exploring these questions. It's very inquiry based. It's not product oriented, even though there are often products that come out on the other side.
Yes.
But we're not, I think we're, you know, as artists, we're a bit different than designers in the sense that we don't seek to solve problems. We seek to create things that didn't exist before. And I think that there's an important distinction in that. and that creative practice can lend these capacities of world making and creation to a wider kind of like co-creative act in reimagining, recreating society in new ways. Hmm.
It's so interesting to hear you talk about like the role of the artist in forming spaces. And that's also what you're doing in a leadership capacity too. You're giving people information about how they're activating a space to potentially transform it. I'm curious if you have different definitions of leadership across your different practices.
I can share that one of the definitions that I like and that, you know, evokes some of the thinking that I've done around leadership is that leadership is our ability to respond generatively to what a moment is asking of us in service of collective thriving. I know that's long. That's long. But it has some parts and like just to unpack it a little bit. So within that statement, you know, our ability to respond generatively, like what is the capacity to respond? What informs a response? Like how we are attuned through ourselves as bodies, through our ability to sense the world around us, we are attuning, and that attunement and the way that we pay attention shapes our sense of reality. And that is ultimately what we're responding to. We're responding to a sense of our reality that is determined through our visceral embodied engagement with the world. Like this is the basis of all cognition. It's the basis of thinking. There's no conceptual thinking that arises separately from this self in the world engagement. And so this like ability to respond, you know, well, generatively in service of collective thriving requires a deep attunement and an expanded attentional awareness. So this is where we start to see clues about what should we be practicing? Well, we can practice a deeper attunement. We can practice an expanded attentional awareness in order to respond in right relationship, to respond toward an aim of collective thriving. And that, like that piece, that tail toward, like in service of collective thriving in the definition is something that like wasn't there at the beginning. And that, like, I recognized seemed essential because, you know, responding to what a moment is asking of us is can also be a moral response, an ethical response, like a response that's coupled to an ideology or a certain politic. And so the notion of collective thriving feels like it's an essential, fundamental politic that we need to embrace if we're going to move toward this paradigm of relationality. Like if our decisions are realizing missions and goals and visions and mandates, but are not in service of collective thriving, then they are inherently coming at a cost.
So much of your work, I feel like, also allows people to embrace failure. And I'm curious about how you make sense of both of those sort of paradigms ultimately within the work that you do.
Yeah, I mean, failure in the kind of like industrial era mode of leadership and management is like, you know, often seen as a negative. Like even the word failure, like if you say the word failure and just feel what that feels like in your body, like for me, it's like a collapse. It's like a, like my shoulders are slumping forward and I feel my heart drop. It's like a failure. But you know, failure is really an essential part of a process of learning. And if we're not in a process of learning, then we are not changing. If we're not engaging in novel experiences that we are unpracticed at, then we are not learning and transformation is not possible. And I think this is like a little bit of the paradox of this moment is that we are, because of the dynamics of the world around us, increasingly like as people in a state of distress. And from a state of distress, what we seek is the familiar. We seek the comforts of the familiar because change puts a demand on our nervous systems. It puts a demand on our physical resources, and we are already feeling incredibly depleted. And so it's sort of like this phenomenon. Do you remember at the beginning of the pandemic, this like propensity to go back and like watch old movies from your childhood?
Absolutely. Yeah. Like it's something to just be able to relax around.
Yeah. Something that is not challenging, that is not demanding anything of you, and that you have like already a relationship with that you know might bring you joy or comfort or evoke a sense of nostalgia. But I think so the paradox of this moment is that the imperative of change couldn't be more potent, and our capacity to do it couldn't be more compromised. It's like if you had never like thrown a frisbee before and someone put a frisbee in your hand, the idea that you're not going to immediately fail at getting that thing to fly across the field, I mean, it's inevitable, right? But it's part of the process. It doesn't mean it's going to be like that forever. But we have to build capacity. And I think that's really the thrust of a lot of the leadership work that I've been doing, is what are the new capacities that we need to build that are not the ones we have been building and working on and are well practiced at, that align with this industrial era mode of leadership and being in the world. But what are these other capacities, and how do we slowly over time build the muscles to do this?
It's your last chance to submit to be a part of the Dance Current's Fall 2024 print issue. We are a genre-inclusive magazine, and we want to hear from dancers, movers, educators, audience members, and writers of all backgrounds. What are you thinking about? What are you engaging in? What should we highlight? Send us your ideas for features, photo essays, artist profiles, personal columns, dance criticism, and more to submissions@thedancecurrent.com. Please submit by tomorrow, August 26th, and don't forget to check out our summer issue on newsstands next week. I want to take a moment to like zoom in on Shannon for a second, because I often think about like how we end up in the places that we are, how we end up thinking about the things that we dedicate our lives to, and you know, what got us to the place that we're at now. And what was it that first brought you into this sort of like cultural leadership development space? How did that happen?
Yes, I have a very fun story to tell about
this.
Great. Because it actually, like it genuinely arose out of a creative project. So in 2013, I was developing a project called Everyday Marvels that was a collaboration with the Gardner Museum for Nuit Blanche in Toronto. And so as part of that project, it really had a community focus. It was about engaging choreographers to work with recently graduated dance artists who were cast together with more senior experienced artists. And it was like kind of a shakeup. Like it was meant to shake up the familiar dynamics in our community and allow choreographers to work with different people and allow, you know, young artists to have experience, like a first experience as a newly graduated professional dancer in the field. And also alongside that project, I was in conversation with my financial advisor at RBC, who had like got excited about the fact that I'm a choreographer, because he was part of a glee club at the bank that spent their lunch hours, like they spent their lunch hours singing together. And so, you know, he was like, well, hey, you're a choreographer. Like, do you want to come and choreograph some moves for our glee club? And I was like really taken by his enthusiasm, but in my mind, I was like, no, I really don't. Like, I really don't. This is not, this is like not my thing. I'm a contemporary choreographer and I do very serious work. But I just, like, upon reflection, I thought, oh, this would be such an amazing opportunity to actually engage the bankers in the Nuit Blanche project. And so I proposed back to him that his glee club could work with me to develop an original piece of choreography that would be performed as one of the excerpts that was being performed at May Blanche at the Gardner Museum. And so the, you know, the banknotes, that was the name of their glee club, was
the banknotes. Come on.
Yeah. So the banknotes got themselves together. They rented an auditorium at the bank, and I would go every like Monday evening after work, and we worked together to collaboratively develop a dance work, like a contemporary movement piece. And this was the real transformative moment for me, is because as we worked in this process, they started to tell me that the culture at work was changing. And I was really fascinated by this. And, you know, like the project really picked up momentum. So like other people at the bank started to want to join the group. Like there was quite a few of them. I think there was something like 25 or 30 of them. So we started to interview them and to ask them about their experience. And we realized that we were building a kind of collective capacity as we were creating these dance works. And that collective capacity, unlike a lot of corporate team building things, wasn't about going to a bar and drinking together or going out to eat. It wasn't about golf or wasn't about competitive team building events. It was about collaboration. It was about movement. There were a lot of folks in the group where English wasn't their first language. And so it also provided like a kind of way of relating that was very accessible. And so it was quite a moving project. They did perform all night and expressed some really beautiful reflections about their experience. And for me, I was like, okay, there is something to this. And that really was the very beginning of now what's become really like very central to my work in practice, is how do collective embodied experiences bring about transformative change? Hmm. And then they were so excited about dance that they renamed their group the Mobile Assets, which I thought was hilarious. So that they could include the dance part, which is great.
Yes, of course. Oh, that's so funny. It's so interesting to hear like the onset of that journey being about like your choreographic creative process really showing you what was possible in other realms. And I'm curious if now, having spent a lot of time researching, investing in, and practicing the leadership side of it, has there been a moment where that's like reflected back around to your choreographic practice?
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, I think one is always informing the other. And I mean, it might not be a surprise to you that I'm really kind of obsessed with process, like how process is designed, how it's facilitated, what kind of feelings it evokes for the people participating, how it engages with the agency and creative contributions of people in the group. And so in my own creative practice, I think one of the questions I've been asking is, like, what's the role of a choreographer? And, you know, like, we know that there's a kind of like shift away from the capital C choreographer who comes in with like movement phrases and an aesthetic that comes out of their body that gets sort of learned in the room by other bodies. And to me, this, like, I, you know, there are still likely some choreographers that do work that way, and that their aesthetic has become like their signature, a way of identifying their work. And I've just been questioning this for myself, because I love inviting creative contributions of others. But I think when I want to do that, I also need to invite the possibility of an aesthetic that could, a kind of collective aesthetic that is not yet known to me at the beginning of the process. And really, like, the studio is also my practice ground as a facilitator. Like, I think that this is where leadership development practice has a lot to learn too, because when I think about examples of where there's a potential of this relational leadership and this, you know, generative culture-making process, I see it in the studio. It remains quite invisible, I think, in our field, because you know, what we celebrate in our field is what we see at the end of that process. We celebrate what goes on stage, and we celebrate the artifact of the art and the performance of the art, but we don't actually take time to see or acknowledge the processes that make that art.
Yeah, and it's so interesting, like, to loop back to the idea of an aesthetic that is recognizable across a choreographer's life's work versus maybe what you're describing more as a value-based aesthetic. But then how do we encourage people who are coming to see this value-based aesthetic to understand that there's something deeper to appreciate? And I mean, this conversation isn't to heal our issues around audience engagement, but it's a really interesting proposal of, like, what are the shifts that need to happen in order for our industry to work in a way where we are, you know, appreciating and valuing and giving artistic freedom to both the collaborators and the artistic teams.
I know. I mean, this is the world-making process, right?
Yeah.
Like,
yeah.
When audiences come with certain kinds of expectations because they have certain reference points, then we start to provide new reference points. And, you know, on some level, because we work in a, you know, embodied form where our bodies are the medium, I think there is a visceral connection. Like, I do believe that audiences are sophisticated and discerning, and that when they are witnessing a work where the artists have had a healthy process and are deeply attuned to each other, to the expression of the work, that on some level, even if it's hard to articulate, I think we can sense that. Sometimes we don't always sense the opposite. Like, sometimes when, you know, the performers have not had a healthy process and are, like, in a kind of state of execution of the work, I think we don't always read that, but I think it is also possible to sense that if we tune in. I mean, I think one of the tricky things is that we are increasingly in a disembodied society, and I think that's why dance, I mean, at least in my the lifespan of my career, dance has never been front and center as a as a form that attracts large audiences. I mean, outside of ballet, I would say that has a very robust history of creating reference points for audience, right? Like, to the point where sometimes ballet is used interchangeably with the word dance in Western culture, which is also fascinating and a product of our shaping around our relationship to movement and dance. But, you know, like, with the, like, a world that is quite disembodied, then, you know, we've kind of all had the experience where audiences will come to see a dance work that doesn't have a, that doesn't take a narrative form, and there's a desire to understand the conceptual dimension or narrative dimension of something as a form of understanding, whereas, like, understanding through a felt sense experience or through emotional landscape is just less familiar. And our world is moving heavily toward a digital mediation and a stronger prevalence of, you know, AI and technology that is really, really coupled to a rationalist, data-driven way of seeing the world. And so it just fuels my desire to continue working in these embodied ways, because it's the complement. And it doesn't surprise me that it's hard to invite a rationalist society into embodied experiences, but I also believe that we won't be able to ignore this feeling of dis-ease and unwellness forever, and that we are going to have to start feeling our way into another way of being. And when those recognitions start to come, then here will be us dance folks saying, like, hey, come move with us.
We have
come
the
move
skills.
With us. Yeah. Come move with us. And there was this incredible study that was released recently that was looking at treatment for anxiety and depression, and discovered, not surprisingly to you, Aria, that dance, collective movement and dance, was had the biggest impact, the biggest positive impact on treating anxiety and depression, even more than all forms of drugs.
connected to this train that we're on. It's another sort of like big picture question. We are in a critical moment right now in the arts. Funding is being cut and impact is being questioned, which, you know, articles like this really help support what we're doing. But companies are struggling to stay afloat. And I'm curious if you could offer one reflection or area to lean into that would support the transformation of how the arts world is working right now. What would it be?
Oh my goodness. Well, it's hard to narrow to just one, but I'll try.
You can give us more.
Well, maybe just to start, I think one possibility is to already start thinking beyond art as a system of cultural production. Like, I think one of the offers that the arts world and particularly artist practitioners can make in this moment of big change, and also in this big moment of questioning the value of the arts, is to illuminate the way that art is more than an experience, an artifact. It is more than just a system of cultural production that is an industry sector in society that has an economic return. Like, these arguments can still be useful in certain contexts, specific, like especially if you're talking to the Minister of Finance. But
yeah,
but I think, you know, for broader society, we need to remember that long before a system of cultural production, art was a practice of social cohesion. It was a practice of community wellness. It was a way that ritualized important milestones and moments. It was a way of storying our understanding, our shared understanding of the world. And some of those functions still come through, you know, aspects of the system of cultural production, but why limit ourselves to that forum? Why not start collaborating with healthcare, with leadership, leadership development, with education sector, you know, with urban design? Like, how can these processes that are inherent in art making lend themselves to the imagination of new systems in other sectors of society? And I think this is where we really need to start engaging our imaginations as a field, because I do believe there are other kinds of resources out there that can support us beyond, you know, the grant funding that is dwindling and that is just like heartbreaking to see how many incredible projects, incredible artists, incredible companies are, you know, just struggling to survive. Like, we are in a state of collapse and we can't pretend that we're not. Our system is collapsing inside the arts just like it is in the wider world. And so if we dedicate all of our time and energy to hanging on, we're not going to have any energy left.
My final question to you is, if you're up for sharing, has there been a transformational moment for you in your life as an artistic leader?
Also seem obvious, but the pandemic was a big transformational moment for me as well. And I think the way that it was transformational is that all of the work that I had been doing, you know, in the 20 years leading up to the pandemic, like in the first parts of my career, were about finding a sense of equity inside the public funding system and acknowledging that my experiences as an artist were fraught at times, and I was always kind of looking at the system. And I think one of the moments of transformation for me through the pandemic was like, oh, this system also exists in me. That there are things that I am coupled to that are perpetuating this system. And that for me, systems change became way more personal. And so I think this is like one of like the insights that I gleaned, and that also has become very central to my work, is that systems change work begins with self. Like, we are the system. We are the system, and our behaviors either perpetuate a status quo or they invite new possibilities of being. And so this is something that I'm always working on personally, and hopefully also through my embodied facilitation practice, inviting in others as well.
Yeah, it's personal. And thank you for sharing. To keep in touch with Shannon's work, head to her website, www.shannonlitzenberger.com. And that's our show. The D Word is presented by Dance Made in Canada, a biennial contemporary dance festival featuring Canadian dance artists with unique artistic visions from all cultural backgrounds. The D Word is produced by Mayumi Lashbrook with Taylor Young, editor and composer Jamar Powell, sound engineer Chris Dupuis at 1990 Studios, and cover photography by Marlo Porter. And I'm your host, Aria Evans. Thank you to Canadian Heritage, the Canada Council for the Arts, Ontario Arts Council, and Toronto Arts Council for making the D Word possible. Find us wherever you get your podcasts, and don't forget to rate and review. Let dance transform you.